nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
I think, like I said, we're very proud to have Holmes Ralston III here. Dr. Ralston's a university distinguished professor at Colorado State University. So he's coming from Colorado to the Midwest, which is a big step for anybody. He's widely considered the founder of the field of environmental ethics. Dr. Ralston is a laureate for the $1 million Templeton Prize in 2003. And just to sort of be clear, $1 million in the humanities is a lot like $15 million in science. So 2003 Templeton Prize, and the 2005 recipient of the Mendel Medal for outstanding contributions to genetics and to science, more generally, with concern for the ethical and religious dimensions of the research. Dr. Ralston has written and lectured on reasons for the respect for nature for more than 30 years. Dr. Ralston, also a Presbyterian minister, is one of the world's leading advocates for protecting the Earth's biodiversity and ecology and recognition of the intrinsic value of nature, including the ongoing evolutionary genesis in the natural world. He's written 6 books, acclaimed in critical notice in both professional journals and national press, including Genes, Genesis, and God, Cambridge University Press, Science and Religion, A Critical Survey, Philosophy Gone Wild, Environmental Ethics, and Conserving Natural Value. He's also written chapters in over 80 books and hundreds of articles. And we're very happy that he's here for you to join us. We give a round of applause to him.
Well, thanks for a kind welcome, and I've been on campus 24 hours and have enjoyed meeting people. It's a bit of a humbling experience to be the subject of a biography, but fortunately or unfortunately, that's happened to me. It's an intellectual biography by a man who's now at the University of Montana. 25 years ago, he was a student of mine and began to take some interest in my work. So take care about how you attend to your students, because they might be writing at you or about you. I'm going to pass this around, but I'm going to leave that copy, if you don't have one already, leave that copy in the library here at Purdue. So it'll be there at least. And you might like to buy a copy to see what happens to somebody who, when he was the age of most of you students here, was confused, disoriented about the future and the meaning of life, and kept at it, and some halfway decent things have happened to me in my lifetime. Okay, I want to think about the future of environmental ethics. Let's dim lights a bit. Well, let's first turn to the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, giving us a stark warning. Human activity putting a strain on natural functions of the Earth's systems that sustaining future generations can't be taken for granted. Well, that sounds like environmental concern is in the future. Once almost president of the United States, won the Nobel Peace Prize for his concern about an inconvenient truth. Another, maybe once almost president, and his wife, written a book on today's environmentalist. President Obama is calling himself an environmentalist. Paul Hawken, Australian, says that environmentalism is the largest movement in the world. Not a single movement, but that collectively the many different organizations that are green or are concerned with a sustainable future, he thinks, larger than any other single movement in the world. Some years ago, I did attend the Rio Conference, 1992, with the largest number of heads of state ever to gather in one place, concerned with the environment. The Pope last year made a statement on environmental, dealt with various things, dealt with environmental justice. I'm asking, thinking perhaps that we are at what I might call one of the ruptures of history. Well, when Columbus arrived in 1492 for Native Americans, it was a rupture in their history. Their future was never going to be like their past. Or when we got Copernican astronomy, Galileo, the worldviews were going to change. Or when we had Darwin with his evolution of species, worldviews were just going to be radically transformed. And now I think environmental concerns are of that order and kind. Well, what might it mean? That's what we're going to explore. Some say we're at a rupture of history because in the future, Earth is going to be a managed planet and nature is over. One way of putting it is like this. Since humans began, there's been a biosphere and there's been human technology, but human technology has been contained inside the biosphere. But from here on, increasingly, the technosphere will dominate the future of the planet. And so far as there's biosphere, it'll be managed. It'll be contained within the technosphere. Let's go back to the thought of a visionary, maybe a philosopher, Henri Bergson, who said, if you can imagine thousands of years in the future, looking back, the Second World War, the First World War is not going to be that big on the scene. But the steam engine and the locomotive's power that we get from steam and petroleum and jet planes and electricity, essentially, we might want to say motors and gears, the vast powers that we have in the modern world, are going to shift an age as dramatically as the coming of fire, or as dramatically of shifting from the Stone Age to the Bronze Age. The technosphere will serve to define an age. Some say that the future is a post-natural world. Post-natural. It's a world of virtual nature. Yes, we have nature in the parks, in the gardens, in the zoos, but it's a highly managed nature that's in some sense post-natural. Bill McKibben, a friend of mine, he's not a philosopher, but he has enormous philosophical insight, laments that we are at the end of nature. The character of the world is changing. No such thing, he says, as primeval, elemental nature anymore. Or if we turn to Michael Soulet, another friend of mine, a great conservationist, but he laments again that at the end of this century, the biotas will, yes, there'll be some remnant and some native species, but there'll be partly or completely engineered species, and there'll be vast numbers of exotic species. And he continues, the term natural will disappear from our working vocabulary. Or another ecologist, Daniel Botkin, nature in this century will be a nature that we make. We have the power to mold nature into what we want it to be. Or turning to a philosopher and a good friend of mine, perhaps he has spoken here, Baird Callicutt, nature as other is over. Shift to new kind of nature, he wants to phrase it that way, that includes humans as one of its components. He wants a postmodern concept of nature with humans sort of in the picture. And yes, he says, as a good ecologist must, philosopher must, you've got to pay some attention to the ecological impact of our technologies. Well, is the rupture then that we're facing an end of nature? Well, we might want to ask, is nature sort of already gone, Bill McKibben sort of thinks. There's a Scandinavian study that says if you ask what terrestrial nature is little disturbed, it's half of it, but half of it is often Sahara Desert or Arctic North or something of that sort, not habitable nature. If you look at habitable nature, he says 27% is yet little disturbed. What's partly disturbed, again, as habitable nature, is about a third. And dominated nature, again, some third of the landscape. These figures may not always total exactly to 100%, but they convey a main idea. Well, you can look at these figures and say that's pretty gloomy because the dominated or partially disturbed nature is three-quarters of the terrestrial planet. But you can also put a different spin on these numbers. You could say, well, the little or partially disturbed parts of nature are two-thirds of the planet. In another study, Peter Vitusek and others say that humans now capture 40% of the net productivity of the terrestrial landscape. And again, you could say, well, that's a kind of a dismal figure, but it does mean that 60% of the planet's photosynthetic productivity is still sort of in the wild. I like to use this diagram, if you can remember your trigonometry a little bit. An ellipse, unlike a circle, an ellipse has a double focus. Can we think of one focus of an ellipse as culture? It's certainly prominent on the planet. Another focus as nature, which is still present on the planet, as we were hearing. And yes, much of the planet is a hybrid between nature and culture. Phrase virtual nature, I'm picking up a couple of places, but we have a woman on our campus who says the Colorado River, which of course a major river in the West, is a virtual river. Well, we might hope that the Colorado River is sort of wild and free, but she says, no, it's so heavily managed that practically every drop of water in the river is flowing where and when it flows because the water engineers have punched a button to let this amount go through this dam here and there or hold it back or so forth. Well, maybe the Colorado River is a virtual river, at least the lower parts of it. Upper parts of the Colorado River, which are not too far from where I live, have no dams and might still be thought to be wild. Do we want to think increasingly of Yellowstone Park as being virtual Yellowstone, or in the east, Adirondacks were supposed to be wild and free? Do we want to think they're going to be so managed that they are virtual Adirondacks? The Colorado River does begin in Rocky Mountain National Park. Do we want to think of a park, my park, near me as being virtual? Have you got a virtual Wabash River running through town? Is it so managed and controlled that you can't think of it as a genuine river? Okay, managed nature. Do we want nature to end? If we think a little bit about how these managers are doing, we might have some misgivings, because it looks as though global warming is a result of our efforts to enlarge the technosphere, and it may be, well, too hot to handle. Upsetting the climate sort of changes everything. Maybe that ends nature. It shifts the character of what's in the air, the waters, the soil. It may shift the composition of forest, plants and animals that can grow here and there. It may shift ocean currents and shorelines. We may be able to grow wheat where we could not grow it before, but we may be unable to grow wheat where we can grow it now. Values of property may shift. We just had a Copenhagen conference where the Chinese and the Americans and Indians and others were negotiating their national policies facing global warming. John Houghton, a climatologist, again a friend of mine, kind of startled the British public by saying that he thought global warming threatened British security more than terrorists. Why? Well, he pointed out how many British people live near and depend on the shoreline. And if shorelines were to change much, he thought it would greatly threaten British security. Steve Gardner, a philosopher, says that global warming is a perfect moral storm. A tragedy, perhaps. An unprecedented convergence of complexities, because you're mixing nature and technology. You're mixing uncertainties at global and local levels. You've got choices to make scientifically about what the models predict, which ones are good ones, which ones may need refining. You've got choices to make politically about whether the Copenhagen Agreement amounts to much, what you can expect to accomplish with international agreements. You're worried about the justice or the spillover from the rich to the poor. The Chinese are going to think one way about this matter, the Indians another, the South Americans differently. You've got to worry about future generations. You've got to worry about the distribution of benefits and harms from global warming, whether we sort of owe it to third worlds because we're caused the problem, or whether it's charitable or benevolent of us to help out the island nations who fear for their future and wish to make plans in case sea levels rise. Certain people might be thought of as bearing these risks voluntarily if they have powers to change and do not, but many people will bear the risk of global warming involuntarily. Maybe it will happen, is already happening today, but to a certain extent there's a lag time between what we do now and what the outcome of it 10 years, 20 years, 50 years from now. Situation in which we do a good thing, it's a good thing to develop, a good thing to have power, and yet it accumulates into something that's globally bad. And in that context, you're doing a good thing. You know, it's easy to deny that the good is having more bad outcome than we thought. It's easy to say, well, tomorrow the engineers will figure out how to handle these problems. It's easy to say, well, I'm not really that much at fault. I don't think I carry that much responsibility about this, or even to be hypocritical about it. It's easy to be what moralists call a free rider. You can even cheat, or you can veil corruption, as is often often the case in this country and in others. And we have learned that there is much corruption in high places. You have individual and national self-interest, what's good for the Americans, often at odds with what's good for global interest. And so it is what Garrett Hardin called a tragedy of the commons. I wasn't altogether happy with that term in years gone by when he sort of tried to say that all environmental problems are of that kind. But I do think that idea and that phrase is useful dealing with global warming. A tragedy of the commons is I've been describing, when everybody sort of does what seems good from his or her local perspective, it accumulates into a tragedy of the commons. We have very fragmented agency with different people making different contributions to CO2 and global warming with different powers to act. Some people have virtually no power at all to do anything about global warming. Many people can act, but may think it's sort of senseless to act. I mean, I might spend a little extra money and buy a hybrid car and save some emissions, but my roommate will just go out and buy, in the West, buy a bigger, more high-powered SUV. And what have I done? I've just funded his increased emissions, if you like. The Danes say, the Danish people, well, and Swiss people, well, we can do a lot within our nation to stop global warming, but what difference does it make, right, if India and China swamp us out in everything that they do? We're in a situation in which government and business, the kind of two big influences in our lives, may force us to do things that are environmentally disruptive. You know, I don't have much choice but to drive an automobile to buy my groceries. But if I drive more than 6 miles round trip to buy groceries, my wife buys a lot of the groceries. She likes to look in more than one store, right? If I drive more than 6 miles, the consumption required on my automobile virtually offsets any kind of green shopping that she could do in any grocery market that she might get to driving a few miles, for example. Well, is any hope? Am I simply giving a gloomy message? I'm going to worry about that some. There are overfishing agreements that seem to me to have had considerable success in international ways. We've had success about whether we continue whaling or not. Not as good as we like, but we've made success. We have the law of the sea. We have the Convention on Trade in International Endangered Species, right? These have been reasonably successful. The Montreal Protocol, which deals with hydrofluorocarbons, many say is the most successful international agreement in human history. And maybe we've got some hope. But global warming has proved especially difficult to get into as tight a focus as we could endangered species or even the chlorofluorocarbons. And we're not sure what future lies ahead of us. Partly because we face what look like going to be nonlinear or cascading shifts. And it looks as though increasingly we've got the power to make changes when we can't foresee all of the results. We wouldn't make the change unless we could think we could foresee some of the results, okay? But they're going to have unforeseen results, and sometimes we can see that there are going to be some bad results, but we are powerless to change them. Whether we have hope or not, to a certain extent, depends on what we think about human nature, what we think about human capacities to face unprecedented crises. Well, I want to turn to that. Human nature versus, it's going to wake you up if you've eaten too much pizza, what I'm going to call Pleistocene appetites. Well, human uniqueness, ancient appetites. I said already that we live in an age where we've got motors, we've got engines and gears, we've got enormous technological powers, but others say, yes, we do, but we've still got muscle and blood appetites. Develop that here. Well, some say if you're thinking about appetites that we would have had in our ancient past, presumably we ought to have some love of nature since we evolved in natural systems. We once were hunters and gatherers. We ought to have love, Ed Wilson calls this biophilia, for our natural environment. And to some extent we do, I think, but it's essentially weak before our desires for what? Technology, for building. Neil Everton says humans are the natural alien, and sort of the idea that the one thing humans do that other species don't is they rebuild their environments. They make artifacts. Humans have an appetite then for wanting more, for wanting to transform their world. Well, Pleistocene appetites. You like sweets, don't you? You like fats. You like salt. Why do you like these things? The biologists tell us we like these things because that's what you had to have 10,000 years ago to make it through the winter. You get all the sweets you can get, eat all the fats you can. Salt's hard to get, right? That's why you like sex, right? You need all the sex you can in Pleistocene times to bring the next generation into existence, because most of your children will die. All right. So now they claim humans are driven by these sort of muscle and blood appetites at a time when you can get enormous amounts of sweets, fats, salt. Well, at a time at which there is more sexual freedom than there was before, and we don't have any sort of natural controls on these. We're built, they say, for overconsumption, and we get fat. We eat too much. We're built for sexual desires, and we get overpopulation as a result of this. We're built, they say, for sort of pushing back limits, for wanting more without sort of controls on these basic wants, and they can get us in trouble. So now the claim is we have a kind of deep-seated belief that we'll get, that life will get better. That's kind of what we've been taught for centuries. That's kind of what the pioneers thought when they settled this new world, right? You ought to hope for an abundant life and work toward obtaining it. That's the good life. Economists think that's what it means to be rational, right? Is to sort of maximize your powers to exploit natural resources. And then they may say, well, isn't that a good thing? You give people more and more of the goods and services that they want. Well, we may say, well, that's the economist who want constant development, and they think people will always want refrigerators, and they'll want technology when they can get it. They'll want more money in the bank. They'll want a bigger floor space in their homes. But now if you turn around and say, well, okay, what about the philosophers? They may say, oh, well, we're not always sure we agree with economists, but we think there ought to be a right to self-development. There ought to be a right to self-realization. You got a right to abundance, and everybody has a right to abundance. So it turns out that if you've got these kind of appetites pushing you, even if you're looking out after yourself, or if you're looking out after your neighbor, what are you going to get? You're going to get escalating consumption. Whether you're seeking your good, or if you're a missionary in foreign lands trying to teach them how to raise more corn, how to have more development, you're going to get escalating consumption. So now people are asking whether humans are well equipped to deal with the kind of global scale problem that we now face. Many of our institutions, the family, tribe, the village, nation, law, medicine, I think even school and church, were designed to build a sort of local community, to build it better, to make it more abundant. Are they up to the global scales that we face? And in general, people a long ways off, or people who are remote in the future, they don't sort of grab us much in terms of what we think we ought to do or must do. So there are people who are saying that these genes, which once got us through the Pleistocene winters, are increasingly going to prove maladaptive. All right. Well, what you think about that worry mixes, to some extent with how much you think we can get a wider vision of our self-interest. I mean, there are various ethicists now who say you can expect locally some charity, some benevolence, but in international relations and on the world scene, the best you can do is collectively to enlighten self-interest. Can that happen? Will that happen? Well, in my lifetime, one of the marvels has been the European Union. When I grew up, the Germans were always fighting the French, and the French fighting the Spanish, and the Spanish fighting the English. The history of Europe was a history of war. But we've got the European Union, which I think has collectively enlightened the national interest of much of modern Europe. I said already the Montreal Protocol does show that we can do things in terms of global interest. And we've got some 150 international agreements that deal with environmental concerns. I do think we have these sort of basic gut-level instincts which we inherit from our past, if you want to call these Pleistocene appetites. But I think humans are an unusual species. I flew here yesterday in a jet plane. I checked my email last night on the internet. We have decoded our own genome. We have designated world biosphere reserves. I've been in on some of these sorts of things. What am I saying? I'm saying that we do lots of things at levels that have nothing to do with our sort of Pleistocene inherited native abilities. We have some vision of humans as a unique species that can transcend their own local appetites. I don't want then the idea that we've sort of got innate ancient genetic dispositions to get to be an alibi for continuing our excesses. Think a little bit about sustainable development, sustainable biosphere. We've got people now saying, well, sustainable development's a big thing. We've got 150 nations have endorsed it. 130 of the largest corporations have endorsed it. It's a good wide-angle lens. It can be orienting about our sense of direction. We can form coalitions. It sets thresholds. It allows China to do it one way, India to do it another way. But now I want to ask, well, what does sustainable development mean? Does it mean we're going to develop? We've got to prioritize the economy and do what you like to the environment just so long as you don't undermine the economy? Or could it mean that in some sense we're going to prioritize the environment, right? Yes, we must have an economy. But you got to work out that economy within a quality environment. Needs to be sustainable development according to the United Nations. It takes first priority. But if you talk to ecologists, they may say, no, the better phrase is sustainable biosphere. Ecological Society of America, it's the most important task we face today. All right. Thinking sustainability is a big buzzword. You've had Brian Norton here preaching sustainability. And I'm asking what kind. There's a big problem with sustainability if you continue these escalating appetites. I said that we've switched into a new epoch. Some call it the Anthropocene epoch, the area epoch of engines and gears, right? And I want you to just look at a series of graphs. You get an impression from these, six or eight of them. Just kind of watch 1950. GDP takes almost a right angle turn. Damming of rivers, again, 1950. Takes almost a right angle turn. And we're going to use that water. 1950. We're going to irrigate lands with it. We're going to have to put fertilizer on lands. 1950 again. Or if you switch from powers of agriculture to motors and gears, transport vehicles, 1950 again. If you look at energy use from inanimate sources, that the power we get from engines and gears, motors and gears, it looks like this. And of course, if you couple it with the population, 1950 again, it looks like this, right? You put these kind of graphs together with these kind of powers, these kind of numbers, and you've still got this appetite for more and more and more. We could have quite a challenge in the future. Well, we want more and more and more, and that's a problem even if we try to get it equally for all. But in the future we face, the problem often is that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, isn't it? If you look at the gap between the rich nations and the poorer nations and how it has shifted, if you go back to 1820s, essentially in the early Industrial Revolution, it was about 3-1. If you come forward to that magic number of 1950, the gap between the rich nations and the poor countries was about 35-1. If you come to 1973, it's about 44-1. In 1972, when the UN met at Rio, it was 72-1. It's hard to get recent figures. Many think now the gap between the rich and poor has escalated to about 100-1. All right. So now you may say, look, we have dramatic wealth. Bill Gates and a few others own more wealth than all 40 or 50 of the least developed countries. The richest 2% own more than half of the global household wealth, right? Okay, so then we need ethics. We need some sense of environmental justice. We have to speak the truth to power, as the saying goes. So let's look at somebody who did. Here's Joe Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winner, a marvelous economist, worked for the World Bank as a result of winning the Nobel Prize, and he's got quite a conscience as well. The devastating effect that globalization can have on the poor, decisions made at IMF that seemed bad economics, thinly veiling special interest. Chief economist at the World Bank until a economic crisis. He was chief economist 6 or 8 years. And he saw how the U.S. Treasury Department and the IMF responded. And I was appalled, he said. Well, for saying these kind of things, he was essentially forced out of his position. He's had some interesting things to say more recently about the financial crisis. We've learned in philosophy that power tends to corrupt, and if we remember Lord Acton, absolute power corrupts absolutely. We've got to worry about increasing power with its power to corrupt. We've got to worry about those Pleistocene appetites, but that's not simply among the poor or among us who think of ourselves as ordinary people. This sort of drive for endlessly getting more can drive the rich as well as the poor. But the drive is going to harm the poor far more than it does at the rich. If you worry about an economist, here's the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. We lack a robust basis for linking ecosystem services to human well-being, and the poor are the most vulnerable. Well, what's the future? The future, in some sense, we've got to realize that people and Earth have entwined destinies. I think that's been true in the past. I think that's going to be true throughout the new millennium. And quite a challenge to work that out. One of the things we have to work out in that is whether when we save biodiversity, we do so because it's good for us or good of its kind. Ed Wilson calls the biospheric membrane, the miracle of life on Earth, right? But Millennium Ecosystem Assessment again, we've accelerated extinction rates up to 1,000 times over those typical in Earth's history. Right? Well, someone may say, it's easy to say, oh, well, extinctions have been going on. You just indicate here. Extinctions are going on all the time, aren't they? So there are more extinctions than ever. But 1,000 times more, you see, with natural extinction, there's space left for respeciation. But with artificial extinction, our kinds of extinction, it just shuts down life on Earth. There are not many new species generated on Walmart parking lots, for example. Maybe we are bringing an end to nature after all. Well, no, it'd say, oh, we got to save things because we need to save things that have medical or industrial agricultural use. But do we save what's good of its kind? Well, if I go back to that Rio conference, they say humans are at the center of concern. This called a Rio Declaration. It was to have been called an Earth Charter. But many of the developing nations didn't want any talk of an Earth Charter. We had to name it a Rio Declaration for the lack of a better name. They wanted humans at the center of concern. And certainly we do want to be concerned about humans. Here's a couple of economists thinking about this disproportionate distribution of wealth. We've got to make an important gift to the future with our concern for human rights. And so they continue, you must never save the environment at the expense of the poor. And you can't. They're right. You can't be proud of a policy that somehow saves nature at the expense of the poor. But you have to take another look at that. We're not proud of an ethic that says the rich should win, the poor should lose. I thought I just made that point using Joe Stiglitz. But turn to the World Health Organization. Priority to human health raises a dilemma if it conflicts with protecting the environment. ensure human benefits, human survival. That's first order. Respect nature, if you can, as a second order principle. Okay. Everybody's going to, of course, that's humane. That's humane. You got to feed the people first, right? Then, if you can, save the tigers. Okay. But I claim, at least on the basis of my experience, that the World Health Organization policy, always put people first, means there'll be no tigers, there'll be no rhinos. There'll always be people who want to put cattle in the tiger sanctuaries. There'll always be people who'd like to shoot the rhinos and use their horns. If you're going to preserve, you've got to conserve, and that sometimes means you're going to have to reserve it, make it a sanctuary for wildlife, of which we have some 600 in some 80 countries, and say what comes first here, at least, is wildlife conservation. Well, we're going to get people who say, well, no, people have to win, right? You're going to have a win-win ecology, Michael Rosenzweig calls it. You got to figure out some way to keep the elephants and get the Africans, all of them, fed. And there will be a win-win ecology. On my campus, we have these signs that say, recycling, everybody wins, right? When you recycle, nobody loses. And now we say, well, actually, the global crisis is like that. If you can get in harmony with nature, everybody will win. The best you can do is to get people saving rhinos and tigers here and there because it's in their self-interest to do so. So you're going to get some tourism, and that will give them some food, some sugar, some salt, some money in the bank, especially if you're in a free market democracy. You've got to prefer humans and give them their effort to have more and more abundance, right? Always prefer humans. Always prefer Americans, first order, right? Canadians come second. The British come second. We've got internationals, I expect, in this office. The Romanians. One of my hosts is Romanian. They come second. You say, you know, that's outrageous, isn't it? Well, it may be outrageous, but here it comes from George Bush. First things first are the people in America. Outrageous? Well, what are we going to say? First things first are people, and the wildlife comes second. The elephants, tigers, they can live only if they're worth more to us alive than dead, right? If we can make some money off of them, we'll keep some tigers. Huh? You know, I think there's something naive about sort of saying one species saying, we always come first, and other things, if they're good for us, they can stay around on the planet. Putting it politely, perhaps, we are primary and they are secondary. If we continue our extinction rate in the future, we're not going to be proud of destroying this miracle we've been given. And now people may say, I say, you're going to win, but you've got to change your goals. You can't win unless you get your values right. You know, my ancestors were slave owners. They lost the war, But they won because they had to change their goals and see blacks as human citizens important in our economy. I've seen women's liberation. Maybe some of my male colleagues lost jobs because they gave priority to women. But men win when women enter the workforce and become useful and prominent citizens, as we have discovered. But now they may say, well, yes, but if you say that, you say you win, but you're sort of moving the goalpost and saying, well, winning used to be winning the Civil War, but now winning is having blacks incorporated into the citizenship of the nation. And that, they may say, you seem to be winning the argument this way, but you're moving the goalpost. My answer is generally, well, if you're playing football, you can't move the goalpost to win the game, right? But if you're doing ethics, maybe you do have to move the goalpost and say that every form of life is unique, as the World Charter of Nature says. To win, we're going to have to get more respect for the miracle of life on the planet. Maybe more respect for the planet. An earth ethics. I was taught to be a good citizen when I went to school. I hope you're being taught to be a good citizen. We now say in the Rocky Mountains we need to think. We also teach them to be good residents on the landscape. Isn't ecology, after all, the logic of a home? Yes, we need to be good citizens. We need to be good citizens of the American nation. But we have to realize that this is often different from what it might mean to be a good resident dwelling on this home planet. See, we're kind of in a situation where we fight for what we value in nature, our natural resources, but we say they are the resources that Americans need, the resources that the Chinese need, and we protect them with our armies, with our policies. We keep sort of nationalizing natural resources, rather than thinking of them as a global commons. Look at the two words earth. Earth, uppercase, earth, lowercase. See? We may say dirt, right? Dirt is obviously a natural resource. Now, dirt has no value except as we can get bread out of the dirt, right? I want to look at the uppercase earth, earth in that sense, and think of it as a marvelous planet, maybe the most valuable, not valueless, dirt, but the most valuable entity of all, because it generates us, it sustains us. I want us to think about the value of life as a creative process on earth, and not simply to be always be asking how much more can we exploit that environment. Right? You need a little real estate. I own a little real estate. I own about a quarter of an acre, the house on which I stand. So yes, that earth belongs to me. But I want to think in a certain sense, I belong on earth, that we belong on earth. At my college, we sort of said, what do students need to know that we didn't know, we didn't get taught when we went to school? Well, they need to know the Pythagorean theorem, yes, but we still teach them that. Maybe they need to know in philosophy, Thomas Aquinas, arguments for the existence of God, yes, we need to teach that to the next generation. But what's different? What's different is the next generation has got to be computer literate. Computer literate. Is that all that's different? No, we said the next generation has to be environmentally literate. I was taught to be a good citizen. They taught me nothing about being environmentally literate. I would hope that you can't get out of Purdue University without being computer literate. Can you get out of Purdue University without being environmentally literate? You'll have to answer that. I can't. Here's Boutros Boutros-Ghali closing the UN conference. Civic conduct, he calls it still, but what are we loving our neighbors? Yes, continue to do so, but we have to learn to love our world. A contract with nature, a contract with earth. You want to think of ethics as a social contract. We've got an ethical contract with this earth that gives us our life. Well, he's a politician. You may say politicians have to make good speeches to stay in business. Let's listen to a rocket scientist. Here's Edgar Mitchell. Slowly from behind the rim of the moon, there appears a sparkling blue and white jewel, sky blue sphere, like a small pearl in a thick sea of black mystery. Well, we don't have two Earths. We just have one, don't we? Small pearl in a thick sea of black mystery. Maybe conserving life on Earth is the way we have to think of ourselves. Belonging on this planet. I remember when I looked back at my fragile home, now Michael Collins, tiny outpost in the black infinity. Earth is to be treasured, something precious that must endure. Well, perhaps we are looking at the future of environmental ethics. It's the elevation of a world vision, an urgent world vision. We're searching for an ethic of respect for life on Earth. That's the future of environmental ethics. Thanks. Let's have a little conversation about this. Questions, and there is a microphone since this is being recorded. Comments? Additions, subtractions, got you all convinced, looks like, got you all dumbfounded or something. Full of pizza, that may be your point.
I'm curious, do you support more of a preservationist idea or a conservationist idea?
If I've got to answer that, preservation versus conservation, I would think of myself what we need more desperately is preservation. I think that sort of people will wake up to the need for conservation, maybe too late. But enormously, people can see that they haven't got the water they need. They can see that they haven't got the timber they need. They can see that we've got to conserve the soil. We're not doing that very well. But at least the prospect of that happening is reasonably good when people get rise up in concern. Yeah. In general, people are not that motivated or animated about preservation, about saving wilderness, about saving the grizzly bear. They want those kinds of things, about saving endangered Chapman's rhododendron or something of that sort. That doesn't turn them on with as much vigor as to notice that the crops are failing because the soils are gone. So I think the emphasis, and that will be lost, right? In your lifetime, my lifetime, in my lifetime, we've already conserved some 600 wilderness areas. But what do you lose first? What do you lose first? You lose the remnants of wildness that do remain on the landscape, practically gone in much of Europe. Not all of Europe. Europe's done a fairly good job. But many remnants of wildness are still on the landscape. On the Rocky Mountain landscape, where I am, they're more in evidence than they are here. Right? Once they're gone, right? Once the Walmart is there, the wetland is gone. So that's why I tend to emphasize preservation. It seems to be need to be the thing that most radically needs to be done when and where it can. I get faulted for that. People say Ralston is trying to save the tigers and he's trying to save the grizzly bears, and he's uninterested in getting the poor fed. I just worry that if we get the poor fed, there won't be any wildlife left in Africa on free on the landscape. Yeah, they're waking up here.
Okay, we'll go over down the way.
Well then, because there are a lot of problems with poverty and everything.
Oh,
there are lots of issues with poverty around.
Issues of poverty?
Right. And so a lot of forests that are being cut down are so that people can, you know, grow crops and feed themselves and or make a living. So
yes.
How do you help people make a living then without hurting the environment?
The most notorious article I ever wrote is called Feeding People, Saving Nature. And I argue in that article that there are times when we ought to save nature, even if we are no longer feeding people. And I've been accused of being hating people. I use as an example Nepal. I spent some time in Nepal. It's a marvelous nation with many hungry people. In an area of Nepal called the Terai, it was once saved on account of the mosquitoes. That is to say, it was too malarious for people to live in. In the wet season. So essentially, often said maybe 9,000 people lived in this area. Until the coming of capacity to kill mosquitoes, and then enormous numbers of people came in. Well, while it was saved, before it was saved as a hunting preserve in the dry season for nobility, often British. The British did not own Nepal as a colony, but they were in India. But often the wealthy of India and the wealthy of Nepal and so forth. They came and hunted there. They hunted tigers, they hunted deer and so forth. So there were lots of tigers in this area. And there's a tiger conservation area. There's a good park there. Well, now what have you got? You moved from some 9,000 to 9 million. Nepalis, they want to live on that landscape. And they do live on most of the landscape, but maybe 5%, 8% of the landscape is still tiger reserve. Well, you could feed people by giving up on the tiger reserve. Do they do that? Well, they let the people go in there and cut thatch and so forth. They don't let people to bring their cows in there because that will destroy the tiger reserve. Is that inhumane and cruel? Maybe so. My argument, though, is that, well, okay, let the people say, let the people go in and clear the forest and take their cattle, convert it to a cattle range. What will happen? What will happen will be that in 10 years, you got 10 million people instead of 9, just as hungry as they ever were. You haven't fixed the problem in the right place. Fix the problem in the right place. So you've got hungry people who would like to take their cattle into the tiger sanctuary. But if they do, that isn't going to solve the problem. Right? You've got to deal with the inequitable distribution of wealth, even in a nation like Nepal, and certainly in a nation like India, which has other tiger sanctuaries. What I'm saying essentially is that I find few cases or none where the problem couldn't be fixed by redistributing wealth that we already have. Take that if you want on the loggers in the Pacific Northwest. They say we'll be out of jobs if we can't cut down trees, and you guys want to save the spotted owl. I say, okay, you already cut down 90% of the old growth forest. Cut down the last 10%, and what? You'll be out of a job 10 years from now, even though you got work for the next 10 years. That doesn't fix the problem in the right place, right? Get some transition in other forms of the economy. Great disaster in Haiti. Tragic disaster in Haiti. What are you going to do with these people? Well, you could move them from Haiti to wilderness areas in the United States, put them to work cutting down timber. They probably could raise some cattle in Yellowstone National Park. They probably could make a living in state parks around here. But you say, no, it's not a good idea to bring immigrants from other countries who are hungry and put them into our wilderness areas. It doesn't permanently solve that problem. It's a temporary fix that ignores the main problem. So basically my answer to you is that cutting down forests in order that the poor can live on them, everywhere I've seen it as an option, is fixing the problem in the wrong place. That way in Brazil, right? They say, send these people into the Amazon and they can make a living there. It's not fixing the problem. There's great inequitable distribution of wealth in Brazil, right? Typically those people, it's not good soil for converting, it's laterite soil for converting. It just doesn't fix the problem in the right place to cut down forests for the benefit of cattle.
How much people are you can repeat the question?
I don't think you used the word sustainability in your slides. I might have missed
it. I used sustainable development, sustainable biosphere.
So how does this craze around sustainability fit into environmental ethics or the other way around?
Craze around sustainability. uh, You're right. Craze around sustainability. It's because 100 people can use the term and mean 100 different things. It's an umbrella that can be used to cover everything. Okay. So this is what? This is a green building full of entrepreneurs, right? Every one of those entrepreneurs is going to want to say that what they're doing is green. Is it or not? We have to look again. I said we got to worry about whether what we're going to sustain. Is it essentially going to be sustaining economy and making sure that the environment will sustain that economy? Development, just so long as we've got ecosystem services that will enable us to develop. Or is sustainability mean, think about sustaining the biosphere. Think about sustaining life on Earth. Think about sustaining that marvelous planet. Is that what sustainability means? I think you got people whose worldviews are 180 degrees apart all claiming that same word.
This is a bit more of a personal question, so I hope you don't mind, but I'm just so very interested. You mentioned that you were raised to be a good citizen,
yes,
but not necessarily to be environmentally ethical.
In terms of my education, yes. In terms of the farm people with which I grew up, I might not give the same answer.
Well, I was just wondering what it was that you experienced or encountered that inspired this respect for nature.
It's a little hard to say. Well, I grew up in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. How many of you have been in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia? Right? That's God's country, if you like. It's a beautiful place. Why? It wasn't slaveholding country. It wasn't good cotton country, good tobacco country. But you could make a living, a good living on the farm landscape, limestone country, limestone low country with high mountains on either side, right? So I grew up with farm country surrounding me. My dad was the pastor of a rural church in a beautiful area, the Shenandoah Valley, with farmers around. And if I looked in this direction, Jump Mountain, which was in the National Forest. If I looked in this direction, Hogback Mountain. If I looked in this direction, another mountain. I had mountains on my skyline in a rural area. And who were these people? Who were these farmers? They were Scots Presbyterians, right? They loved what? They loved gospel and landscape. They loved gospel and landscape in Scotland. The Scots landscape is not an easy landscape on which to make a living. It's been much transformed. When they came to Pennsylvania, when they came to Virginia, they sort of loved gospel and landscape. So I was brought up in that sort of culture. Sort of looking at nature surrounding me with a people who respected land. They respected land. It wasn't sort of big industry agriculture. Yes, Cyrus McCormick invented the reaper there, but he had to come to Chicago to get it manufactured because a reaper is no good on the Shenandoah landscape. There are too many rocks out there bulging up and so forth. They were entrepreneurs, if you like. But they had this sense of what? God's creation, good creation. They had this sense of community, of living on their landscape. In that sense, they were people residing on a landscape. And I think that came out when I was taught in college in Central North Carolina, taught to be a good citizen. That sort of came back. And then when I first position, I was mentioned I was a Presbyterian pastor. I was a pastor in the Valley of Virginia. I got to be a good naturalist there. I got a sense of the beauty of that landscape again. And I kept having to fight what I was being taught. I was being taught by the theologians in those days, don't pay any attention to nature. Pay attention to Israel. Pay attention to salvation history. Karl Barth thought theology of nature was nonsense, right? I had to fight that. But then when I got to the philosophers, I thought, well, the theologians haven't got it very straight. What am I? I'm going to learn philosophy of science. I'm going to learn philosophy. They get it straight. So I did a what? Excellent thing. I went to what was then one of the best schools in the nation in philosophy of science. Stupidly, I went. Stupidly, not. University of Pittsburgh, big in philosophy of science. I poked my head in the door. They did admit me there, and they said, "What do you want to study?" I said, "I want to study philosophy of nature." "What? Oh, you mean philosophy of science, don't you?" Right? I said, "No, I really mean philosophy of nature." Right? Well, they had to do some thinking. Right? They thought nature was value free. Right? Yes, that's what you learn in science and in philosophy. They thought what was of value was what science can do, what it can understand about the natural world. But to sort of want to do philosophy of nature, they thought, look, Thoreau and Emerson have been dead and gone, right? Forget those guys. I had to fight philosophy, and I had to fight theology. To do what? To kind of be what I am, but somebody's been listening. I mean, I did win the Templeton Prize. You got a lot of philosophers. I did give the Gifford Lectures, fairly famous lecture series. And I, you know, the guys I went to school with who have physicians at Princeton, Harvard, Yale, or whatever, they said, wait a minute. Right? Ralston, isn't he the crazy guy that went out to the Cal College in the West and wrote this stupid book called Philosophy Gone Wild, right? Right? How come he's given the Gifford Lectures? How come he got the Mendel Award? What am I saying to you? You know, I'm saying follow your heart, right? There's a future to you. Don't just do what he says. What he said. Much of the future of this planet, right, lies in the creativity of the sort of people I'm speaking to right this minute. Much that turns on the history of the planet is depends on what's going to happen in the next 30, 40, 50 years. I hope I've launched a movement of environmental ethics, environmental concerns, and I'm trying hard to see that it continues. Okay, thanks for being a good audience.